You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the horticulturalist at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville and hear about the history of the gardens there and get some advice for our own spring planting.
First, when young professionals around the United States think about great places to work and to live, places like New York and San Francisco, Portland and Seattle are seen as hot commodities. Wisconsin, not always at the top of the list.
That can be bad news for the state's economy, since those young professionals can bring money into the state along with skills that companies need, and some of them could be a big part of business startups, too.
This week is Young Professionals Week in the state, with events that highlight what Wisconsin has to offer and to build connections and expand opportunities.
Angela Damiani is with us now. She's CEO of Newwalkie, a lead organizer of the event. Angela, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, you guys.
And Laura Schulte is also with us. She's a reporter at the Wausau Daily Herald, where she's been covering Young Professionals Week. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Angela, what's the goal of Young Professionals Week?
Well, there's a couple of goals. When we started this in 2012 in Milwaukee, the primary goal was to help local employers connect to this very covetous millennial audience, right? The ones that aren't paying attention to normal means of communication or advertising and aren't applying for jobs or staying at their jobs for as long as their predecessors. And we ran this program with tons of success for a couple of years. It was really sort of this golden key to the city of Milwaukee. Where to work, where to live, where to play. It's a sort of a conference in that it has multiple different tracks on lots of different topics, everything that might be interesting to a young professional. But it happens all throughout the city. So for people who are new to the city or interested in exploring the city, it's a way for them to sort of get a behind-the-scenes tour, as well as access to local public officials and CEOs and things of that sort. And then in 2015, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation approached us about leveraging the platform we had built in Milwaukee to really explore what it means to be young in the state of Wisconsin, knowing that, A, there's employers across the state who have similar challenges getting a hold of this audience, and B, there are young people who probably know why they've chosen the small towns and cities that they have to start set up their lives. And so the sort of secondary exploration here is really around what it means to be young in Wisconsin, and it's about the young people in this state who've already chosen to live here, finding a way to export to their peers, both locally and nationally, what it means and why it's really special, what they love about it, as well as to give them a platform to change the things that they don't like about it, to enter into some of those harder conversations about things that need to be improved, and to give them a seat at the table around some of those civic discourses that usually young people opt out of for whatever reason or just simply not included in.
And this has gone statewide now. And Laura, let's bring you in. What sort of things are we seeing going on in the Wausau area this week and in general with talking about making this an attractive place for young professionals?
So we've got a big variety of different events. This morning, we kind of kicked off our week with a sunrise cycling class at one of our local gyms. And this afternoon, we're going to have a speaker crawl, which brings in local speakers to talk about a variety of different topics, everything from media literacy to how to use love to unite the community. And throughout the week, we have a lot more events. We have a LinkedIn workshop where we're going to have professional headshots available for people. We're going to have a jam session to bring young musicians together. And, of course, at the end of the week, we're going to have a brewing workshop with one of our local breweries.
Talking to Angela
Damiani. A lot of different events.
A lot of different stuff. Talking to Laura Schulte there with the Wausau Daily Herald and Angela Damiani from Newwaukee. Talking about this week's Young Professionals Week. A lot of events going around the state. And Angela, are there common themes that you hear in the Milwaukee area and as you've expanded this around the state, common roadblocks, obstacles to bringing young professionals into communities big and small?
I mean, I think that there are. there. But what's really nice about this platform is it gives a chance for people to find what they love and change what they don't, and for the young people to have their ideas heard and made actionable. I mean, it really does put a spotlight on the onus of the young people. And the week itself is different in every place. You just heard from what's happening in Wausau. I mean, I know up in Shequanamcom Bay, they're having a smelting event. In Eau Claire, they're doing something around cubbing. I mean, it really has been sort of like adopted and adapted to be reflective of each individual community. But what's cool about it is it's all being united by a single theme. Called Think, Make, Happen. And the idea is that if you think big, you can really make just about anything you possibly dream happen. And that has been really, really exciting to see how that's sort of the response of each individual, like organizing, young person group has been really creative and dynamic and reflective of what's sort of curious or interesting about each place.
And Angela, you've been doing this, as you mentioned, in Milwaukee for a few years before it went statewide. Have you seen changes coming out of Young Professionals Week already just in the last few years?
Yeah, I mean, there's been this really interesting willingness to work together beyond the week itself. So one of the great byproducts of collaborating on such an intense production is that obviously there's a peer network now that's willing to do all sorts of new things. So we are seeing a new collaboration in partnership with the Bright Star Foundation come out this spring and summer called HASH, which is centered in central Wisconsin, Wausau, Marshfield, Wisconsin Rapids, and Stevens Point are each hosting pitch events for people who are interested in taking that sort of napkin idea and turning it into an actual startup. The young people are leading this because they're concerned about the sort of lack of new startups that are coming out of central Wisconsin and would like to do something about it, would like to raise awareness to that issue and then give a platform and a voice to their peers. So that unto itself is really exciting that after April 29th, when everyone sort of goes home, there's more ways for these groups to work together and to continue to make this a better place for everyone to enjoy.
And Laura, staying in central Wisconsin, in your recent piece on Young Professionals Week, you talked to some of the young professionals who are involved here. Do they have this feeling that they're part of a community, or are they just seeing themselves as an isolated bunch of people in similar positions?
Well, I can actually talk to you. So I've been one of the coordinators here. Mm-hmm. I'm one of the co-chairs here in Wausau for YP Week. And talking from personal experience, YP Week has connected me so much more to this community. I moved up here just about a year ago with no connections here in the community, and YP Week has not only given me a connection, a group of friends, but it's made me feel much more connected to the community. It's opened up a lot of doors, and it's shown me just how passionate this community is and how willing to include young professionals everybody is in this community.
And Laura, as somebody working in Wausau, if you're talking to somebody maybe out on the coast who says, Wausau, Wisconsin, geez, I don't know. I don't know if that's the place I want to work. What do you say to them?
I would say don't count it out before you visit. Come visit. Get to know the people who live and work here. It's a great place. There's a lot going on here, and the city is really putting a lot of effort into making this a more attractive place. Just look at some of the things that are happening, the riverfront development. It's a wonderful place to live. There are a lot of opportunities, a lot of resources. I would say definitely don't discount it before visiting.
And Angela, do you see, as we wrap up, some momentum going on here? Laura just mentioned, the city getting involved. You mentioned earlier WEDIC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Are leaders, whether in government or outside, taking this issue of attracting young professionals more seriously?
I think across the board there. I mean, particularly in the private sector, when we first started this, it was just sort of a passion project for us. And we were hoping that people would come out and want to get involved. And now we have, the largest employers in the state participating because they realize that if they don't participate, we need all boats to rise in order to, kind of shift the tides of our talent migration needs here for our future workforce. And that for me is like the most satisfying part of this, to know that it's not just a bunch of young kids getting excited about their hometowns, but to know that we have all the right people at the table to really make a dynamic shift.
We'll leave it there for now. Angela, thanks for joining us today.
Perfect. Thank you so much for having me.
And Laura, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Angela Damiani, CEO of Nuwaukee, and Laura Schulte, reporter at the Wausau Daily Herald. They were talking to us about Young Professionals Week in Wisconsin. There's event info at ypweek.com. If you're like me, you may have spent some time working on the lawn and or garden this weekend. I have a pretty small yard and a very small garden, but even so, it can seem a little overwhelming.
Our next guest has a little more on his plate this spring. He's working on 20 acres of land with over 20 different styles of garden and 4,000 varieties of plants.
Mark Dwyer joins us now. He's director of horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. He's here to tell us about the gardens and maybe share some advice for our more modest efforts at home. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you gave me a tour, Mark, of the gardens back in late October. I imagine things look a little different now that it's April. Paint us a picture of what's going on.
Oh, absolutely. Well, in Janesville, of course, with some recent heat and kind of a warm spell 4 to 5 weeks ago, spring has really sprung here, so to speak, at the gardens with a lot of color, a lot of emerging leaves. Some of our earliest flowers and bulbs are blooming. So the explosion in color over the last 3 weeks on the southern end of the state has been unbelievable. And it's a matter of feeling like you're ahead of the game a couple weeks ago and now feeling like we're a little bit behind, just trying to keep up.
Now, the Rotary Gardens are a big highlight in Rock County. Can you tell us just a bit about the history of the gardens?
You bet. You know, the gardens themselves are situated on 20 acres of City of Janesville land. We are a private nonprofit. We don't receive any city funding. But the intent of the gardens, these 20 acres when they were founded over 27 years ago, was to provide horticultural education and appreciation for everyone. So the 20 acres includes 26 distinct garden styles, over the 4,000 types of plants, and we do a lot of great educational events as well. So the gardens themselves are meant for people to enjoy, to be inspired, to learn, and certainly bring their families and enjoy just sort of a respite of color and imagination, because this we do see about 100,000 visitors a year, and we always hope to see more people.
You mentioned feeling like you're playing catch-up now. I feel that way on my lawn, but again, you're working on a lot more. Can you talk about the work that goes into gardens this size when it comes to the staff and volunteer labor that goes into it?
Sure. Well, you know, at Rotary Botanical Gardens, we're, I think, unique, not so much in that we utilize volunteers, but to the extent in which we do so. For instance, today I had about 20 volunteers this morning working on mulching and composting, some early season planting, doing a lot of wonderful things out in the gardens. And, you know, to keep up with that, we actually have a very small ground staff. What we've been able to do is augment our efforts throughout the organization with volunteerism. So our volunteers contribute about 17,000 hours a year, and that's over 400 people, and it's just amazing what we're getting done.
Now, someone like me, I'd worry about volunteering, you know, oh, I pull this thing, it's not a weed, oh, it's the plant you actually wanted, but it sounds like there are a lot of jobs that are Rob-proof, if we can put it that way.
Well, we sure hope so. We'd love to have you here, Rob. You know, the gardens themselves, for instance, not an hour ago, I gave a tour for a new volunteer who his interest was in learning plants and being involved, contributing back to the community and dedicating time here. So we take all interest levels, and a lot of our best gardening help aren't necessarily true gardeners. They're interested in helping mulch and gravel paths. So it's learning what people want to do, what they're interested in learning, and accommodating, you know, tailoring the task to our volunteers. And that includes education and working in our gift shop and special events. So it runs the gamut of opportunity.
And you mentioned 26 different styles of gardens. What are some of the things people will see there?
Well, the gardens themselves are about 50% formal gardens. For instance, an Italian formal garden, very linear in its form, a French formal garden with a lot of roses but a lot of symmetry, and then more informal areas like a Japanese garden. We have a prairie area, a shade garden. So those 26 distinct garden themes represent not only perhaps different types of plants, but those garden styles as well. So it really is a sequence of rooms and experiences throughout the 20 acres.
And do you do specialty things from year to year where it's a one-time-only exhibit?
Well, I think we're real unique in that about 40% of the gardens is entirely different each year. So we'll pick seasonal themes. We do a lot of annuals, those plants that we transition every year to have color themes. Our big color theme this year is a Gothic theme, so dark reds and blacks with a little bit of silver. And that color scheme has changed every year. But we have a hummingbird haven, an heirloom garden. So again, 40% of the gardens is different. So we want repeat visitors to say, you know, I wonder what they're doing this year.
Talking to Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville as we're in spring planting season here. And Mark, let's talk about some advice for people who maybe are working with a little less than 20 acres on their own gardens. Let's start really small, container gardens. What kind of advice do you have people getting started on that?
Well, container gardens, you know, first of all, know your climate, and I would advocate for any type of gardening this time of year, regardless of where you are in the state. There is still potential frost, so don't jump the gun with any tender plants at this point in time. But getting back to containers, it's real important to understand you garden not only in the container with what you select, but with the container, with its appropriate placement. You want to make sure you have adequate drainage in those containers and a good soil mix that's well-drained. So the science of container gardening, the plants are the last part of the equation. The other ingredients are the soil, again, and proper preparation. So really know what you're getting into and then have fun with the plants that are appropriate for the site and, again, that container.
Right. Say we've got shady things going on. That I assume that rules out veggies in our container garden for the most part.
It really does. There's very few vegetables that will withstand any great degree of shade, but you're not limited with color. There's so many great opportunities for a shady garden like begonias and caladiums and some other great plants that will offer color and interest. But again, most of the herbs and vegetables, you would focus on a full sun situation.
And are there vegetables that do particularly well in containers?
You know, there are many, and I think it's important to realize when you have container vegetables, certainly select varieties that might be more expensive at the store. The idea is the cost savings, but certainly growing vegetables at home is a great way of getting fresh produce and the joy of growing. There's a lot of compact forms of what we consider standard vegetables, like tomatoes and eggplants, smaller basils, smaller statured herbs. So the container soil volume will dictate a lot of what you can plant in it, but I would encourage people to look for smaller, more compact forms of vegetables that are still productive, and also shorter vine length vegetables, meaning squashes and zucchinis and pumpkins that don't encompass a lot of square footage, but can actually be grown productively in a small, a decent sized container, I should say.
You mentioned timing to watch out for that frost, and we've got, of course, people listening from Janesville on up to Superior and lakes and inland. What's the most reliable resource to say, okay, we're going to put up the go sign now, it's time to start planting stuff?
Right, and you know, what we consider an average spring or season nowadays changes so much, but the USDA and their zone mapping gives a pretty accurate representation of what we would consider last frost. So, you know, for us in Janesville, the potential for our last frost is between May 10th and May 15th, but we've had it later than that. And the unfortunate thing in our portion of the state is when it gets real warm towards the end of April, as we're seeing now, there are a tendency to think, boy, we're in the clear, so let's go buy those tomatoes. Let's go get those impatiens. And you can really get in some trouble if you have those out in the ground already, because it just takes a dip into the 30s, and we could have some damage on those plants.
Now, one type of plant that seems to do really well for me, even before the frost, is every kind of weed imaginable. What kind of prep can we be doing to get the weeds out of the way? We can be doing a lot of work even before we're getting stuff in the ground.
Sure. Well, you know, it depends on how people feel about chemicals, because there are pre-emergent chemical controls for eliminating some of the early germinating weeds. However, the window is past for us in this area because things are already coming up quickly. We do a lot of manual removal. And so we're out there already collecting weeds and disposing of them, but we also will focus on some significant mulching. So there's areas where we're adding shredded wood chips, shredded leaves. There's areas where we're trying to augment the soil, protect soil moisture, and also hopefully eliminate a large weed crop, which we'll continue to see through the season.
Now, you work, as you mentioned, with over 4,000 species of plants there at the gardens. Are there plants, do you think, wow, these do really well in Wisconsin? Why don't more people have these in their yards and gardens?
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? I think I start leaning towards the talk on natives in that regard, because when you think of native plantings, and that could be some of our grasses, many of the perennials we might find in our natural areas, they lend themselves to our soils, to our climate, to the types of conditions they're growing in natively. The trick in a home landscape is to replicate those conditions. But what we're finding is some of our stalwart, hardy natives are outperforming a lot of the more exotic plants that might be a little trickier. So, you know, again, it's a matter of knowing the plant and fitting it to the correct space. But keep in mind, you know, plants have a reverse expectation of you. You want it to perform, but you have to provide the appropriate conditions for it to do well.
Yeah, why do you think we don't do more with natives? Are they not as flashy as some of the plants we like to plant?
I think that's exactly it. I think there's a lot of promotion for some of our non-natives or the exotics, which certainly have a role in the garden. But the native plants, you may not, again, have that flashy alluded to, but what's coming out now are what are called nativars, and that's cultivated, you know, selected varieties of native plants. For instance, like a little blue stem, which is a great native grass. There's some great selections or nativars of those that are have an increased blue coloration or a better fall color. So I think you'll see in the next decade or so a push for these excellent natives and some of the selections of those natives.
Suppose we want some good bugs around. You mentioned, the bird family, there's hummingbirds, but also people are thinking butterflies or bees of various sorts. What kind of things can we think of there?
Well, I think it's important when you consider attracting pollinators to the garden, and it's unfortunate that when we have visitors here that get upset about seeing bees, and their concern, of course, is about being stung, but we try to point out that the pollination that's occurring out there is extremely important. But picking pollinator-appropriate plants, those that are heavy in nectar and pollen, that'll provide food for these critters. You know, we have this hummingbird haven this year with plants for specifically hummingbirds, but the importance of providing a chemical-free environment, water sources, appropriate to have water available, but also, again, a segue of blooms of interest throughout the entire season for pollinators from right now all the way through hard frost, and, you know, again, a wide range of plantings to attract the widest range possible. So there's a lot of literature out there and appropriate pollinator-friendly landscapes, and it really starts with, a good plant palette and avoiding those chemicals.
We'll leave it there for now. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Of the various promises that he made, President Trump's immigration policies have been some of his most controversial, especially when he pledged to do this.
I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall.
Yeah.
Mark my words.
Yeah.
That's President Trump announcing his candidacy back in June 2015. He's maintained that promise since becoming president. In a recent Twitter post, he said that Mexico will, quote, eventually pay for the wall.
But there's still controversy over the cost of the wall and who will pay for it. President from Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, refused to pay for the wall earlier this year and also scrapped his trip to the White House in January.
Now, as Congress works to pass a stopgap funding bill or risk government shutdown, the president is making a case still for funding the wall.
Mordecai Lee joins us now. He's a professor at UW-Milwaukee, where he specializes in government and politics, also a former state legislator. Mordecai, welcome back.
Thanks, Veronica.
So, Mordecai, why is President Trump using this stopgap funding measure coming up to make the case for a border wall?
Well, I guess this just isn't what we learned in, you know, high school civics. What we learned was how a bill becomes a law. Now what we're talking about is it's called a CR, a continuing resolution. In other words, that all funding for the government would expire at the end of this month. But if they pass a CR, then they're continuing to fund it. So the negotiations right now are what will be continued to be funded and what other things will be added to it. And that's where he's putting in his request that they have at least a down payment of some real money to start building the wall.
Now, the way it's being portrayed, Democrats and Republicans were actually playing pretty nice on this one, getting along, and it looked as though there was not going to be a government shutdown in the future. But you throw the border wall into the mix, and suddenly everything becomes a lot more contentious. How does that change the ambiance there in Congress?
Well, I think you're right, but probably right now what's going on is going to be very similar to the health care bill. In other words, Democrats are going to be sitting on the sidelines with their arms folded. We're not going to vote for it. There's nothing to talk about. And then the Republicans in both the House and Senate have to generate enough votes on their own to pass it. What happened with the health care bill is that there was what's called the Freedom Caucus, the Tea Party Caucus. They said they didn't like the bill, and so there weren't enough votes to pass it on the floor. I think what's going on is that the media is hinting that there are some Republicans, that if Democrats are excluded from the picture. There are some Republicans who are either against having a wall, or they're against funding it, or they're against that much being funded. So I think this is still going to be a kind of intra-Republican fight instead of a bipartisan fight.
And do we know how much the wall is going to cost, or at least what the initial funding request is?
You know, the estimates are sort of what we'd call back-of-the-envelope estimates. I've seen numbers like $20 billion, which, even in Washington, that's serious money. But the White House apparently is trying to be flexible by saying, we just want enough money to start. In other words, sort of a billion here or a billion there. And one would think that that would be much easier to do. But nowadays in Washington, just sort of nothing is easy to do. So the White House is sometimes sort of hard-nosed about its negotiations. Sometimes it's sort of cooperative. It's really hard to read them on a day-to-day basis.
You said you think this is going to ultimately come down to being a fight among Republicans. Can you walk us through what the various factions in the Republican Party might be thinking and what objections they might have?
Well, the New York Times today really prominently played the fact that they had contacted all the Republican members of Congress who have districts that border on Mexico, and that they didn't find a single member of Congress of those districts who was in favor of the wall, period, let alone funding the wall or having a down payment on the wall. And so I think what the reporter was trying to hint, but couldn't say explicitly, was that there are Republicans who are either more moderates and don't think a wall is a good idea, or want to have comprehensive immigration reform, and that these various factions are having trouble sort of coalescing around it. I guess what you call a good enough compromise as opposed to a perfect solution in their eyes.
And I guess if there were to be a government shutdown, do we know who it is takes the fall for that shutdown?
Well, I think in this case, it's just so odd, Veronica, because we're used to these government shutdowns where it was Republicans on Capitol Hill and there was a Democratic president, whether we were talking about Bill Clinton years ago or whether talking about President Obama, and that the showdown was a partisan conflict over sort of policy priorities. The last time when it happened under President Obama, it was because there were some Republicans in the House who said, not another dime for the federal government until Obamacare is repealed. And President Obama, of course, said, well, that's a non-starter. And so there was a government shutdown, and public opinion held Republicans responsible for it. And so they felt that they had engaged in a blunder. Now here we've got this odd situation of a Republican majority in the House and Senate and a Republican president. If there were to be a shutdown, which I think is unlikely, it would be wholly on the part of the Republicans. I can't imagine that Democrats would play in the sense of being a factor in it. Probably the most likely thing is that the Republican Party does not want a shutdown. It's bad for their brand. And so it's possible that by Friday night they'll do something that you and I would consider silly. They'll extend government funding for 7 days or a month or something like that, or they'll kick the can down the road. But sometimes it's easier for politicians not to make a big decision than to make one.
Talking to Mordecai Lee right now, professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, talking about the stopgap funding measure before Congress and President Trump's push to include border wall funding in that measure. And you mentioned, Mordecai, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and there's some talk that President Trump may be looking to leverage subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, saying, you know, I'll give you some subsidies for the ACA, and you give me some funding for the wall with Democrats. Could that work?
I think you're right about the reporting, that that's exactly what the White House has offered Democrats in the Senate and House. But I think that that's something of a non-starter, because what Democrats have been saying, they of course support continuing Obamacare, continuing to support the subsidies for insurance companies. But I think what Democrats are saying is, we wouldn't get much if you're merely giving us subsidies for, let's say, the current year, because you guys want to repeal Obamacare effective, let's say, next year. So for us, this isn't much of a gain. But, Veronica, I think you're onto something, because as far as I can tell, in the Senate, a continuing resolution is subject to what's called a filibuster. In other words, continuing debate that's endless, unless there are 60 votes to end debate. to get 60 votes to end debate on the what's called the CR, the continuing resolution, they would need to get some Democratic votes. So the Democrats do have some leverage, but I think they just want to be sure they're not held responsible for anything.
Does this seem like a unifying proposition for Democrats? You know, it depends on who you believe, but by some reports, the Democratic Party is in disarray. Are they out of touch with the common American? Are they not? What do they agree on? Who should be the face of the new Democratic Party? But it seems like they can all disagree on being against the border wall.
Yeah, it's a unifying concept in their sense, and I think they're still trying to work out what it means to be the minority party. In other words, the model of a minority party from when you look at Republicans during the Obama years was simply no. They were Dr. No, you know, the famous James Bond movie. And so Democrats are saying, well, let's be the party of no. Let's just let Republicans hold all the blame. But I really think that goes against the kind of an internal culture of the Democratic Party of, come on, guys, we have to be responsible. We have to believe in governance. We've got to do our part. Let's be constructive. So I think that's exactly what will be going on behind the scenes, Veronica.
Well, if you look at what's next on President Trump's to-do list, I mean, the border wall is there clearly, but you also have tax reform and maybe a new reform of a health care plan. How could what's happening now affect either of those prospects?
Well, when he said that he gave up on, when the president said that he gave up on repealing Obamacare, he said the next item on the agenda is tax reform. And there really hasn't been much movement on tax reform, in part because Congress has been off for the last 2 weeks. They're reconvening tomorrow. Sort of they're flying into Washington tonight and tomorrow morning. I think beginning tomorrow, we're going to start having a sense of what it is their priority will be. You know, President Trump, for his first 100 days, has gotten the success of a Supreme Court nominee. He's gotten some successes, but a lot of them have been by executive order. In other words, what he can do unilaterally. He hasn't had that much in terms of success with Congress. They passed some bills to repeal some regulations, rules and regulations, but not a lot. So I think they might be feeling a bit frustrated. The sense of timing when you're in the White House is different from when you're sitting on Capitol Hill. So they're a little bit off right now.
Mordecai Lee is our guest right now, professor at UW-Milwaukee, and we're looking at a continuing resolution right now to fund. Congress is working on funding, and President Trump is pushing to include border wall funding.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Congress approve funding for a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico? Should the White House, should leaders in Congress risk a government shutdown over the issue of the wall? Should Democrats, especially in the Senate, where they can filibuster, compromise and allow the wall to avoid a government shutdown? Call in with your thoughts on the budget and the wall. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing the conversation with UW-Milwaukee Professor Mordecai Lee, looking at President Trump's push for Congress to approve funding for a border wall and the stopgap funding measure, or maybe risk a government shutdown.
Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think Congress should approve funding, and soon, in this continuing resolution for a U.S.-Mexico border wall? Do you think the U.S. will have to cover the cost for it to be built, or do you believe, as the president says, Mexico will ultimately pay for it? Should lawmakers who oppose the wall compromise to avoid a potential government shutdown? Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we take our first caller now. We have Dana on the line in Cottage Grove. Dana, hi.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I just have two questions for your guest. One is, he mentioned that the $20 billion for the wall, estimated cost of the wall, is even high for D.C. standards. What about the $7.1 billion in cash that President Obama gave to Iran? Was that high in accordance with D.C. standards? And then my other question for your guest is, he mentioned that the Republicans will be blamed again for the government shutdown. Are Republicans always blamed for the government shutdown? Do Democrats ever get blamed for anything in his point of view?
Dana, thank you for that call. And Mordecai, what do you want to say to that? And also, there have been times, I believe, when the party who was going for the shutdown was seen as, you know, there's a heroic angle to that to supporters. What do you say to this one?
Well, I'm glad Dana called because he added a lot to the mix. Probably the answer to his first question is that the money that he describes as Obama giving Iran was frozen Iranian money in the U.S. bank system that, as part of the nuclear treaty, he unfroze. So in that respect, those dollars aren't the same as sort of tax dollars that would go to pay for the wall. Unless, of course, the president is successful getting Mexico to pay for it. So, you know, there are different kinds of money. The question about the government shutdown, I don't recall an instance where Democrats caused a shutdown in the sense of being blamed for it. Now, sometimes one could say Democrats should be blamed because, let's say, they didn't compromise with Republicans or something like that. But generally speaking, Democrats have not been thinking of government shutdowns as a plus for them if they insisted on it.
Thank you for that call, Dana. And we'll move to Eric in Green Bay. Eric, hello.
Hi. My thought is that I don't think the wall is necessary, and I think there are enough thinking persons in this country that realize that the cost is prohibitive. We have bigger things to worry about, such as North Korea. The policy we've had to this point has worked, and I mean, if we're so afraid of the public perception of us standing up to this and potentially having a government shutdown, then we're obviously no good at getting our message out there because the Republicans continue to beat us on that game. So if we, out of fear, cooperate with this and there is, you know, this does go forward, we'll be just as much to blame as anybody else.
Eric, thank you for that. And Mordecai, Eric, from a Democratic perspective there, says that there are messaging problems going on and other issues for Democrats. What do you say to Eric?
Well, generally speaking, in American politics, if a president is willing to draw a line in the sand, or maybe we should say a line in the drying concrete, that would be President Trump talking about the wall. This is sort of the absolute bottom line that he wants to accomplish. And so when you're president, you've got lots of tools to try to accomplish something that you're willing to use all of your political chits to accomplish. So I think it's pretty inevitable that Congress, especially because there's a Republican House and Senate, will approve some funding for some kind of wall. I'm guessing that in the long run, it's not going to go for every yard between, you know, the Gulf of Mexico and the Pacific Ocean, that it'll be some kind of perhaps in some places electronic, in some places it might be physical. But generally speaking, I think we should assume that the members of the Republican Party want their Republican president to be successful, and so that they will ultimately, eventually go along with something.
Eric, thank you for that. And Mordecai, I don't think we talked about actual support for the wall yet. We talked about reservations in Congress, but what do we know about who is supporting the wall, how much support there is for the wall?
Well, it's so interesting that the wall became a very powerful symbolic issue. You might say that Donald Trump went from being an unknown businessman to being president because of that issue. This is his signature issue. And what's so interesting is that one could understand that, let's say, people who live in border states that border on Mexico, that they would have strong opinions about illegal immigration or legal immigration. But what was so interesting about the success of Donald Trump's call for a wall was that it mobilized people around the country. People who live 1,000 miles from Mexico, from the Republican base, were just enthusiastic about this issue. So I think he sort of discovered a new issue of American politics that nobody else had really quite examined or identified. So I do think he will ultimately be successful in some respect about that.
Talking to Mordecai Lee right now from UW-Milwaukee, and we'll go next to Peter in Mount Horeb. Peter, hi.
Hello. I'm calling because I'm in favor of Congress spending the money on building the border wall. And I think that the wall could definitely be built, that we have enough, more than enough money to build it. If we were to spend the money that we're spending on Israel, we're spending maybe billions and billions of dollars paying for Israel's border security, we could cut that funding out and then divert it to our own border security. And I think that we'd have enough money not just to build the wall on the Mexican border, we'd be able to build a wall even across the whole Canadian border if we were to completely stop paying for Israel's border security.
Peter, thank you for the call and the thoughts there. Should there be reallocation of existing funds to pay for the wall? Peter's saying maybe even other walls.
Well, I think what Peter is raising is a more basic question, and that's we're so used to from high school civics how a bill becomes a law. You know, it gets introduced, it goes to a committee, there are hearings, there are modifications, there are amendments. Somehow the whole legislative process of debating an issue has gotten collapsed into wording in a continuing resolution. And so when Peter suggests trade-offs or a zero sum of the situation, that only happens in the larger appropriations process, not with a continuing resolution, which really leaves us back at the starting point, and that's that the appropriation process has really become dysfunctional in Washington. It's not working the way it's supposed to.
Well, Peter, thank you for that call. Appreciate it. And next we go to Richard in Milwaukee. Hi, Richard.
Hi, thanks. I'm not sure if your guest was saying that there actually is a possibility of Mexico paying for this wall. I really, my opinion is this is a very grandiose scheme of, and I hate to use this word, but of nationalism and how Donald Trump got elected through the spirit of nationalism. I think the wall is unrealistic. I don't think it's going to do much to stem illegal immigration. And I don't think Mexico is going to pay for a dime of it.
Richard, thanks for that. And at this point, Mordecai, President Trump campaigned saying he would build a wall, that Mexico would pay for it. Right now, he's saying, well, eventually Mexico would pay for it. So in the meantime, the money is not coming from Mexico, but from, I guess, American tax dollars there. So how does that square away with the conversation?
Well, Veronica, you're right on the dot. That's exactly what the situation is. I think for a supportive President Trump, what they would say is, in the long run, if Congress will enact the idea of what's called an import tax, in other words, that we tax imports, then the Trump administration could tax imports from Mexico, use that tax fund to pay for the wall, and that way they'd sort of indirectly be paying for the wall. But that's sort of a triple play in politics. You know, sometimes in politics, things just don't work out the way you hope they do.
Mordecai, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Mordecai Lee, professor at UW-Milwaukee, where he specializes in government and politics, joining us there to talk about President Trump's request that lawmakers approve funding for a border wall in the stopgap funding measure before Congress right now, or perhaps risk a government shutdown.